Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. I am so glad that you're here tonight. We ran a little bit late due to a pre-recorded program for 4 hours, no problem. We're coming to you live October 17th from east of the Appalachians in the plains of North Carolina. Happy you're here with us. Program is going to run pretty smoothly tonight. We don't have a guest till the last hour. We have John Riley with Zero Point Research coming on. Right now he is presenting at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles at the Hilton. And hopefully that's going well. We're raising a lot of energy for something we're going to talk about in the last hour. The solar wind is a medium 427.4 kilometers per second. Just thought you should know, in case you're looking at the Aurora Borealis up there, wondering what's going on between the Earth and the Sun. Sunspot 1112 is connected to a vast network of deep magnetic filaments looping around the Sun's southeastern limb. Now, it's in plain view of Earth now. NASA's SDO, that's the Solar Dynamics Observatory, is monitoring the situation. And I've got to tell you, if you got a chance to go to spaceweather.com, you should look at the photographs that the SDO is taking, because there's a filament on the Sun right now. It is quite amazing. It is more than 400,000 kilometers long, and it's very, very powerful. The fact that this one is rooted in a sunspot could make it more or less stable. No one really knows. We're watching it very closely. The magnetohydrodynamics of sunspots is so complex, not even the most powerful supercomputers on Earth can predict when they will erupt. Now, we've had a couple eruptions from this, but they have not been facing Earth. Since I found this sunspot on Thursday, this has popped up. This very fast-growing sunspot, 1112, is crackling with solar flares. The SDO shows three of the strongest flares in the last 24 hours. There's an M3 at 1910 UT on October 16th, a C1 flare at 0900 UT, and another C1 flare at 1740 UT today. So far, none of the blasts has hurled a substantial coronal mass ejection toward Earth. But anything could happen because this filament is, as I said, 400,000 kilometers long. It is a magnetic, what would I call it? If you've never actually looked through a coronoscope at the Sun, it sort of looks like a sideways tornado laying down on the Sun. And it could snap at any moment. So we're paying close attention to it. Of course, right now it's nighttime, so we're not looking at it. But the SDO is looking at it because it's never nighttime for the SDO. Also, last week we announced that the U.S. Air Force's X-37B, you know what that is? That's the little mini space shuttle. It's a space plane that it had gone missing. Amateur satellite watchers who routinely monitor the secret mini shuttle failed to sight it at the expected times on October 7th and 9th. It is possible that the X-37 has landed We have now found out, as of today, the U.S. Air Force's X-37B space plane, which was not on the screen last week, has been found again. Satellite watcher Greg Roberts sighted the secret mini-shuttle flying over Cape Town, South Africa, on October 12th, 5 days ago. An analysis of the sighting by satellite expert Ted Molscan suggests that the X-37B has maneuvered into an orbit 54 kilometers lower than before. In other words, it's closer to the Earth. Now, questions have been raised. We already know how secret this X-37B mission has been. We don't know how much the Air Force spent on it as it was put into the Air Force's, quote, rapid deployment program. We don't know what system has been put on it, whether it's a surveillance system or a weapons system. We do know that one of the reasons the Air Force was so interested in this little mini shuttle is that it was maneuverable once it was in orbit. Now, normally we put a space shuttle up, it stays up for 5 to 7 days, might dock with the International Space Station, drop off supplies, place a satellite, do a fix on the Hubble telescope, these kinds of things, and then it heads back to Earth after a very close high-resolution telescopic view of the space shuttle determines that all the tiles are in place and it is safe to re-enter the atmosphere. But this little space plane has the ability to move around once it's up there. Evidently, it has a catalytic fuel system on it. Usually that's in the form of a dry powder that's catalyzed to create kind of a retro rocket or retro jet. And they can move it around. So this has now moved in closer to the Earth. The questions that have been raised are along the lines of, first of all, why did it maneuver? It's, of course, 54 kilometers. Once you're out past the stratosphere, is irrelevant unless somebody is tracking it. And during those 5 days between October 12th and October 17th, or shall we say between October 7th and October 12th, when it was actually spotted again going over Cape Town, it was making untimed, unpredicted measurements somewhere on the planet. We don't really know. The fact that this little space plane can run a 9-month mission, 9 months up there, and then return to Earth is quite amazing. The fact that it can move around during that 9-month mission makes it even more formidable. So we will keep you posted. There are experts that are looking at it. We really don't know what it's about. We don't know what weapon system or surveillance system is on it. But we'll keep you as posted as we can right here on X-Squared Radio. For backyard stargazers, the next few nights are the best time to see Green Comet 103P Hartley 2 as it approaches the Earth for an 11 million mile close encounter 3 days from now on October 20th. So set your alarm for the dark hours before dawn. You can easily do it. You don't have to be at work. Those of you that are getting off at work at midnight, just stay up a couple more hours and look. Go outside and look straight up. You will find Hartley 2 not far from the bright star Capella. If you don't know where Capella is, just look up a sky map, break out your Sky Scout, and you can find Capella. It's pretty easy to find in the early morning hours. It's not visible right after sundown. You'll have to wait until Orion is visible. Although the comet is barely visible to the unaided eye, it is easy to find in binoculars, and it looks great through a backyard telescope. Now, let me give you a little hint on using binoculars. They do gather a lot of light. You only need 7.5 or 12. Sometimes you can get 20-power binoculars, have a pretty narrow field of view. But what will happen is your arms are going to get tired. So I'm going to give you an idea here. It's a cheap binocular chair. Those of you that have any kind of swivel outdoor chair, or if you've got an old swivel chair, an office chair, something like that, you want to turn into a binocular chair, here's a great, great idea. I promise you're going to enjoy it. Go to Lowe's and buy some 1-inch PVC. Now, it can be cheap Schedule 40 stuff, or if you really want to make something durable, you can get the Schedule 80 stuff. This is a project that will cost you less than $25. Buy some 1-inch PVC, a couple of elbows, some U-clamps or muffler clamps, and clamp that thing to the verticals of the arms of that office chair. And then clamp your binoculars to a crossbar that you're going to stick between these two 90 degrees that you glue onto this PVC. Just about where your head would be if you lean that back of that chair back. And what it will do, it will hold the binoculars for you. That way your arms don't fall off while you're looking at something, and it'll stay pretty steady. This is the best setup for looking at a comet. All you really need are ordinary binoculars, and you'll be able to see Hartley too. Now, it's quite fascinating, and believe me, starting Wednesday of this week on up until a Friday or even Saturday, you'll be able to see this comet. Now, it's going to look like a little fuzzball up there near the bright star of Capella. The hard part is going to be is that we're at a half moon now, and the moon is only going to get brighter as the days go on here this week. So you're going to have to wait to the early morning hours after moonset, and then you'll be able to see it. Right now the moon is visible during the day, so it's going to cross and set by early morning, and it'll be before moonrise, and you'll be able to see it. And plus, you won't be out there getting moon-burned. There were 27 quakes in the last 24 hours. The strange thing is only one in Peru measured over 5.0. I must say, this is about the most quiet I have seen the Earth in all the weeks that we have been monitoring this for you. We always report on the number of earthquakes in the last 24 hours on Sunday night, just kind of giving you a Saturday snapshot. Usually there's about 24, 25 earthquakes, but we always have 4 or 5 over 5.0, and sometimes some over 6.0, and rarely some over 7.0. And this is one of the few times we've only had one, and this is a 5.2 in Peru. The moon is about half full, and there are three planets visible in the early morning sky. Mars, almost directly overhead. You'll know it because it's the red one. Jupiter and Venus, along with Orion. And then if you look way almost to the east, you'll see, or to the west, you'll see the Pleiades. And if you've got access to a large Dobsonian scope, all you really have to do is look in the newspaper for a Skywatcher group. Do a little Google searching. Those of you in North Carolina just have to get a hold of the Catawba Sky Astronomy Club. They've got a great, a fantastic 25-inch Dobsonian. If you've never looked through a Dobsonian scope, by the way, this is sort of like a long trash can with a mirror in the bottom, and you grab the trash can handle on the side and swing it around and look through the eyepiece that's on the side of the Dobsonian scope. Now, not too good for taking pictures of stars and things like that, but it's awesome to just look through because they gather so much light. And if you've ever looked at the Pleiades through a big Dobsonian scope, they gather so much light. You will be able to see the greens, the blues, unbelievable detail in that. It'll take your breath away, really. You should get a hold of an astronomy club. Take your kids, I would say 7 or 8 years and older. Go to a local astronomy club and check it out. You will be amazed. And now we're getting to the dry season when the hazy days of summer, obviously the warmer areas, the more moisture it can hold, and it makes it more difficult to look at the stars. But as it's getting cooler now, pretty much coast to coast, border to border, you'll be able to get some great, great what we call dark sky events. Go out there, check it out. There, in the next 2 years, if you'll get in the habit of doing it, there are some amazing alignments that are going to take place in the next 2 years. There's a phenomenal, now it's going to be viewable, at least on the western part of North America, an annular solar eclipse. There's going to be a Venus transit in 2012. And you should get in the habit of just going out and doing these dark sky events. You'll like it. Yes, you will meet very strange astronomer-type people who you will not recognize on the street because it's always dark at these dark sky events. But you will recognize their voices and you will make new friends. So I highly recommend it. Earth Observation Imagery Provider, GeoSky. Yeah, really. There's a company called GeoSky, just like you would think about in the movies. Anyway, they plan to move their headquarters to Fairfax County, Virginia, from neighboring Loudoun County, and will receive about $84,000 from Virginia to help with the move. Not very much, but then again, you know, it's mostly office equipment that they're moving. And this was reported by the Washington Post on Tuesday of this week. Now, Joseph F. Greaves, the company's chief financial officer, said GeoSky needed a larger space to consolidate two locations, its main office in Dulles and a facility in Sterling. Now, the new office will provide space to expand, he said, but that's not the important thing to notice about this. I'm adding this. But according to the article, GeoSky considered relocating to Colorado. That's right, Colorado or Maryland, but opted to stay in Virginia to be near its main customer. Now, this is the important part of the article. This is why you tune in to listen to X Squared Radio, because I research all this. I read all these things for you to find the interesting things so you can be informed. Here's the important thing to pay attention here. Not that there's some obscure little bureaucracy that has a small budget each year is relocating from one office to another. No. That's what you find in the news. Listen to this. They opted to stay in Virginia to be near its main customer, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, also known as the NGA. In August, NGA awarded GeoEye a contract worth as much as $3.8 billion over 10 years to provide satellite imagery, not of space, of Earth. That's right. $3.8 billion over the next 10 years to provide high-resolution imagery of you. You'll remember a couple of weeks ago I told you about an article, and it was talking about Congress being upset that the Pentagon was not going to have access to resolutions better than 1.5 meters out of these satellites that are being put up in space. The Pentagon. Yeah, our Pentagon. Not able to access resolutions better than 1.5 meters. We are putting satellites up now that have resolutions of 1 meter, even less than a meter. My question, after I read the article, who's getting the imagery that's sharper than 1.5 meters from out there in space? Who, other than the Pentagon, needs to have imagery better than 1 meter out there in space? That's the question to ask. That's the thing to be watching. Quite interesting. Here on Earth, scientists have discovered a new species of fish living almost 4.5 miles below the surface of the Pacific Ocean. The ghostly white snailfish was found September 10th in the Peru-Chile Trench in the South Pacific by an international team of marine biologists led by Alan Jamieson of the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, my good Scottish brothers. The scientists also found cusk eels and crustaceans living in the trench off the west coast of South Africa. Those creatures had never before been observed at such depths where sunlight never penetrates and water pressure is almost 10,000 pounds per square inch. Jamieson said scientists also observed the cusk eels in a feeding frenzy that lasted 22 hours. Yeah, kind of like college students and pizza and beer. And large shrimp-like crustacean scavengers in abundance in the trench. So, just when you think it's too far down, too far away from the sun, too cold, and under too much pressure, life has a way of happening. Just like it might inside the bowels of the earth. Quite interesting. All right, couple of three or four shameless commercials here. Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel is now out in print. You can buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere fine books are sold. I recommend you go into your bookstore and ask for it. They won't have it. But you can ask for it, and when it does, it forces them to order it, and it helps the book get out there and expand. However, if you buy it from rememberingthefuture.com, I'm sorry, rememberingthefuturebook.com, you'll get some bonuses. You'll get the autographed copy, plus you'll have the bonus of the audio version of the book for free as a download. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. It is also available on Kindle. We're new at that, so I guess you could say we're Kindle gardeners. And now it's available on Nook, which is Barnes & Noble's equivalent of Kindle. So if you go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, you can see all of those links and pick it up for yourself. If you just want the audio version, you can do that too. And it's $7.95, which is cheap for an audiobook, but I want you to have the information, and it helps us out here, helps us keep the lights on. While you're making your plans for this winter, I know you're putting away pennies for Christmas presents for all the kids and grandkids, nieces and nephews, even neighbor kids, if you're really generous. I want you to do something for yourself as well, maybe your neighbors. I want you to go to 1-800-PREPARE.com, and I want you to buy some preparedness items. I don't care if it's a 72-hour kit, a water filter, some kind of thing for your vehicle so that in case you slide off the road or get stuck in traffic this winter and you run out of fuel or you have to, for some reason, shut your vehicle off in order to preserve fuel or keep yourself from being asphyxiated by carbon monoxide poisoning, you'll have something in your trunk that will help you survive. Now, the stuff that you buy at 1-800-PREPARE.com is not only well-priced and well-packaged. In most cases, you get free shipping, and it will last for 25 years. So this is a kind of set-it-and-forget-it storage plan. Buy it once. You could buy the book bag that comes with it, or you could put one in one of your kids' old last year's book bag that's now out of style. Stick it in the hall closet or stick it in the trunk of your car and forget about it. You will now not be a burden upon the emergency providers in your area or wherever you happen to be, especially if you're traveling on the road. I recommend doing it. I recommend doing it with 1-800-PREPARE.com because we have done the research. We have gone through more than two dozen emergency supply suppliers, and I've chosen them for several reasons. Price, packaging, dedication. Paul Faust is a retired EMT, a firefighter. His partner is an EMT in New York City. They feel a calling at doing this. They want to get you prepared. But also because we have checked out the others, the competition, and I can tell you that the quality is better, the shipping is better, the pricing is better, and they have decided to support X Squared Radio, and so we're going to support them. Now, if you go to check out, be sure to put in the code word Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, and you'll get an additional 10% off. Besides paying no sales tax and in some cases no shipping, you'll also get an extra 10% off. That's for you, 1-800-PREPARE.com. My close friend and colleague, Maureen St. Germain, is the creator of the Merkaba Meditation CD. Now, this isn't just fancy music that you sit around and bliss out to. No, far from it. Those of you that have read Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, or are about to read it, will find that I recommend the Flower of Life Meditation as part of the workshop for this book. Maureen St. Germain is my teacher in this meditation, and she has created this CD, which is used by hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people out there to facilitate them to become better perfected at this meditation. It takes a little bit of practice. 4 to 6 weeks, you'll be an expert at it. You will be getting in your heart. You'll be getting answers from the universe and from your higher self. And I highly recommend it. Here's how you get it. You go to MaureenSt.Germain.com. That's MaureenSt.Germain. Maureen St. Germain. If you forget that, the website is inside the book. The website is on the website at rememberingthefuturebook.com. It's also on the website arcofmillionsofyears.com. Click on the link. It'll take you straight to her website, and you'll be able to buy the CD. We recommend it. I use it on a daily basis. And as you're making your plans for the spring, and you live within driving distance of Louisville, Kentucky, I've got something for you. Now, those of us that live in the Midwest or live in the East or live in Chicago or Nashville, we often feel a little left out when it comes to scientific and paranormal conferences. We have to fly to Los Angeles, or we have to fly to Seattle, because all of the, you know, really top-notch conferences have been in the past in Vegas, or they've been in Sedona, or they've been in L.A. Not anymore. In April, April 15th, I want you to pay close attention to the Pythagoras Conference. Pythagoras Conference, April 15th in Louisville, Kentucky. You can click on the link at X Squared Radio. You can put Pythagoras Conference in Google. You can find it. I want you to sign up now. This is the first Midwestern Central Conference of its kind. We'll have 20 speakers, including Michael Cremo, myself, others, William Henry, Maureen St. Germain, workshops, and a superb chance to network in the emerging science and paranormal community. You're going to need this, because in the next 2 years, there are going to be some amazing things coming up. You want to be informed. You want to know who the experts are and who is leading the awareness, the awakening of this area. It's going to happen at the Pythagoras Conference on April 15th in Louisville, Kentucky. There have been conferences before in this region, but nothing this large with the resources that this one will have. 73% of the U.S. is within driving distance of this conference, so it's affordable. And I guarantee that if you have never been to a conference, that you will be amazed and enlightened. I promise you. We'll tell a lot more about this in the coming months. But there are great pricings right now. You should get in on it. Help it to happen. All right? So we'll be back in 40 seconds as we begin tonight's program. Oh, you know, you believe me, don't pass it up. We'll be back. Fasten your seatbelts, Earth Explorers. We're about to begin.
Spice extends life. The spice. expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
We have done a few programs on UFOs here at X Squared Radio. But there's been some recent news, things happening. You know, 4 years ago, we predicted right here on this program that global first contact would occur in 4 years. Well, we're here now. We're here. It's 2010. And it is preparing to happen before our eyes. You feel it, I feel it, and the leaders of the world feel it. We are, this hour, going to take you on a little media trip around the community to hear what is prepared at this time to get ready for global first contact with alien life. The UFO tension is like it has never been before. Not since War of the Worlds was broadcast with Orson Welles has the world, literally, and especially the West, been attuned to the idea, and I'm not talking about the fringe idea, I'm talking about the mainstream idea, something is about to happen. Going all the way back to Ronald Reagan, he sort of prepared us a little bit. We really didn't know what to expect. We were being cautious. We were being, a little protective of ourselves. We didn't really know what was going on. We wanted to not be called a nutcase or crazy. But we're going to lay the groundwork for you here in this hour. And I want you to call in and let me know what you think. If you're calling and you're off planet, you can reach us. You can get to a cell phone tower. It's 530-413-4511. If you're calling east of Earth, 530-413-4515. And if you're calling west of Earth, 530-413-4520. And if you just want to listen tonight without calling in, you can do so on your cell phone, 712-432-0075, and then dial the access code 318-116, and you can listen to tonight's program. President Reagan was asked one time about what we were going to do, why we were posturing ourselves so militarily in these latter days. And he had his concerns about world peace. He spoke about it. This is what he said. Listen closely. Well, I was going to say, I'm not hearing it. It should be playing, but it's not playing. And I don't know why it's not playing. It's Reagan's speech talking about if we're facing down a threat of alien threats from another world, what would we do? There have been sightings, and then there have been sightings. What I'm going to play for you this hour is a collection of mainstream news clips that will prove people aren't laughing anymore. This is happening right now, and it's very real. Now, you know, recently, very recently, we had some UFOs over New York. The reason I'm going to play this is mainstream news.
Alleged
talking
UFO
about this
sighting. Dozens of videos posted online show passersby seemingly staring at a group of unidentified flying objects in the sky over Manhattan. Adding mystery to the event is a prediction by a retired air defense officer. In a recent book, he claimed that on October 13th, the day of the sighting, of course, a fleet of UFOs would hover over the world's principal cities. But many witnesses insist that's indeed what they were seeing, alien spaceships, while others say it looks more like a group of hot air balloons.
Well, now, that's an old argument, isn't it? It's nothing but swamp gas. Nobody's paying any attention to that. Come on, they're just hot air balloons. Well, if you look at the news clips and you wonder yourself, hang on just a minute. If they're hot air balloons, and all these people are calling into the police departments, and after all, this is New York City. This is Manhattan. This is during a time of trying to maintain the sovereignty of the airspace over New York City. I mean, we are under the auspices of Homeland Security now, are we not? And yet not one single investigation was made. Not one helicopter flew up there to get a closer look. Nobody did anything. Oh, and the news clips aren't over yet. Listen to this.
I wish I could give you an answer to this bizarre sighting. I really can't, but I can tell you that earlier today, there were dozens and dozens of people right here on 23rd and 8th. They were standing right here, and they were all in a stupor, just crowded together, looking into the sky. Now, I'm told by this street vendor that at about 9:30, there were these white specks that looked like stars. He said there were like hundreds of them. And then slowly, as the day progressed, they would disappear. So that by 4:30, there were none left. Imagine that. Now, take a look at up into the sky there. Do you see that white thing? To me, that looks like a scar. Looks like nothing to report. You're probably saying at home, fool, that is nothing. But I have to tell you that once my photographer zoomed in to zoom in onto that star, you could see that there was a tail to it. There were these blue flashing lights, and it looked like it was in a broken pattern. Now, was that anything? Was it what people saw earlier? I don't know. I can't tell you. But this guy who you're about to meet, who you're about to hear from, said that for 2.5 hours, he was standing here with his crossing guard, dumbfounded. He said, at first he thought it was a star, then he thought it was a Mylar balloon. In the end, he doesn't know.
I was looking out of my living room window. There were 50 of them. 50 of these stars doing the same thing, clustering together.
I heard a coworker of me saying it was UFOs, it was UFOs. So that's the first thing that came into mind. So when I walked out and I saw it, that is the first thing I thought. Because it was really far away and seemed like stars. And they were disappearing, and then you would see them again, and I had no explanation for it.
My belief, I don't really believe that it was a UFO. But I could be wrong. As long as it wasn't here to hurt us, that's the bottom line.
I hope he saw it, and I hope you saw it, and I hope it is real, because if it is, it's wonderful. We're not alone. That's the best.
In the end, they said that it was handled by patrol officers. They came out here, and by the time they came out here, there was nothing to investigate. So they say that it was unfounded. We also contacted the FAA, and a spokesperson says that they checked their radars, and they couldn't find anything.
Stay connected with MyFoxNY.com mobile.
All right, so there you have it. On Fox News in New York, they're talking about UFOs out on the street with a camera, filming them. Talking to people on the street. Earth Explorers, this is mainstream. This is what is happening around us. And it's not just happening in Manhattan. It's happening in other places as well. Okay, this, you might remember, and it wasn't too long ago, in March of this year, we covered it a little bit on this program. But now there's more out about it, and I want to talk a little bit about this. Over Cleveland, over the lake, we had reports of UFOs coming up out of the water and showing up at night. And this is a top story. So here we go.
Yesterday in this hour, we told you about the mysterious lights that keep appearing over Lake Erie near Cleveland. Here is some home video of the lights that neighbors in the area say are unlike aircraft or helicopters that fly there. And last night, for the 8th night in a row, they said these lights were back, appearing around 7:30 p.m. and lasting about 2 hours. NASA has a lab in Cleveland called the Glenn Research Center. They test rockets and various aircraft, but say they haven't done any testing this week. A Pentagon official told me the U.S. military has not been testing anything recently in that area. And the FAA acknowledges the light pattern seems different from commercial flight paths in the area. So what on earth is going on? Joining us is UFO expert Nick Pope from our London bureau. Nick ran the British government's UFO project at the Ministry of Defense. Nick, first of all, what do you make of what we're all hearing from Cleveland? 8 days, the lights seem to be similar, but they look unlike anything that people have ever seen.
Yes, it certainly seems to be an interesting wave of sightings, and it's always fascinating when you get activity like this over a period of different nights. I think my key question would be, and it's really a question for the Air Force and the FAA, has anyone checked the radar tapes to see if anything unusual was tracked?
Well, as a matter of fact, I spoke to officials at the FAA today. They checked in with Cleveland Air Traffic Control, and they don't have anything unusual, nothing unusual on the radar. No unusual reporting from any pilots. Is it possible that maybe this is some sort of a helicopter or a rescue service from one of the Cleveland hospitals that people east of the city are looking at a little bit differently?
I wouldn't have thought so, and I've seen some of this footage myself, and what struck me about it was the way that it appeared to change color at some stage, and that's quite interesting. I mean, I think as ever, one would need to get hold of the original camera, the original film footage, and do some proper forensic analysis to get to the bottom of it, but it's certainly interesting, and as I say, the fact that it's come back over several nights and been seen by many different people is makes it quite a significant sighting.
Well, and as far as the analysis of the film, we intend to do just that, and it's now several people. We're being told that because this has been happening night after night, people are now gathered on the beaches along Lake Erie near Euclid, Ohio, where this kid first saw it. And apparently, again, for 8 nights in a row, it happens about each night between 7 and 7:30 in the evening. The lights stay up for about 2 hours. Sometimes they dim. Sometimes they get brighter. Sometimes they move up. They move to one side, and then they eventually disappear. What do you make of it all?
Well, most UFO sightings do turn out to have conventional explanations. They can be lasers, searchlights, fireworks, the Chinese lanterns, which are quite popular, and people let these off at parties and barbecues and things like that. But I think what is interesting is that these days, of course, almost everyone has a cell phone with the capability to take photos and videos. So out of the tens of thousands of people who see UFOs each year, we're getting more and more of this interesting footage, so we're more likely to get to the bottom of these sorts of mysteries.
Well, we certainly hope to get to the bottom of this one. Nick Pope from London, thank you so much, Nick. We will keep you posted on how things go over here. We appreciate it. And by the way, we do have some breaking news before our notebook item, and this involves Andrew Cuomo, the Attorney General of New York.
All right, that's all I want to cover of that. The point is that this is happening around us, that we are getting these sightings. Now New York, now Cleveland, and there's even more. There, very recently, over Illinois, there was a sighting. And I don't really know what to make of it. But I'm going to play the audio for you here in just about 30 seconds. It's important to know that this is not fringe. These are not people out there making YouTube videos of some sighting that happened. This is stuff that's happening mainstream. Now, this is a fairly lengthy piece, about 3.5 minutes. It's done by Nat Geo, which is kind of rare for Nat Geo to do. But it puts the pieces together and talks about a sighting over Illinois that makes a lot of sense. Now, you have not only homeowners seeing it, you have police seeing it, you have trained professionals, trained observational professionals, and they track this thing over a series of towns. Now, I think you're going to like this, and the reason I'm putting this together is I'm getting ready to make a point. So we'll round out this hour as soon as we listen to this
My name
clip.
Is Melvin Knoll, and I'm a part-time truck driver, and I own this miniature golf course and also the go-kart track out here. That certain morning, I happened to look over into the sky to the northeast, and I seen a very, very bright light up there, like a very bright star. And then I said, well, that's moving. And I just stood there and watched it as what it was doing. And it was just coming down out of the sky real slow. And no noise, just quiet. And I couldn't see no wings or nothing, just floating right through the midair up there. And I thought, well, if I don't tell nobody that I've seen something go over town tonight, nobody will believe me tomorrow.
Mel drove his truck to the Highland, Illinois Police Department to report an unidentified flying object heading toward the neighboring town of Lebanon.
Mel, this is a huge call from Highland PD. Reference to a truck driver just stopped in and said there was a flying object in the area of Lebanon.
It's a joke, right?
No, this is not a joke.
And for now.
Ed Barton was the first police officer to respond to the call.
Be advised, there's a very bright white light east of town, and it keeps changing colors. It's heading westbound now. Matter of fact, if the shadow officer looks up, they can probably see it by now.
25, just asking something, but I don't know what that is.
At 4:23 a.m., police officer David Martin saw the UFO over a field on the outskirts of Shiloh.
I happened to look over and saw this large floating object that was just moving very slowly. It was probably about a football field in length. It had three large bright lights lighting up the sky underneath it. I honestly don't know what it was that I saw, other than I know it wasn't a plane or a helicopter or a blimp.
Police reported the object over Lebanon, over Shiloh, over Millstad, over Dupo. Detective Mark Lopino says he saw it as it approached O'Fallon, Illinois.
I was driving eastbound on Highway 50 when I see the object, the UFO, if you will. I first thought it was probably a bunch of helicopters flying in some type of formation. As I drew closer to it, I saw it start to cross over the roadway. It was unlike anything I have ever seen before. You could see the lights, and you could see something that they were attached to, and it was shaped like a triangle. I'm freaking out. I'm like, what the heck is this? So I continue, and it's going over these trees. By the time I get here toward the left turn lane, I duck into this left turn lane here, and I stop right about here. I wanted to listen to see if I could hear any type of engine noise. I could not hear anything. I tried to look again at the UFO, and it had already gone behind these trees. I put it in reverse to back up a couple seconds to see if I could reacquire it again. By the time I backed up, tried to see it, it had moved at least a mile away, if not further. That quick, I was just astonished. I didn't know what to say. I was speechless.
Six people, including five police officers, saw an object over southern Illinois that night. They all describe what they saw as a massive triangular object flying in total silence.
All right, so what you have here is you've got audio from mainstream news covering it over New York, over Illinois, over Cleveland, and this is recent, and this is mainstream. Now, recently, and I say recently because in May of 2001, the disclosure folks, Stephen Greer and the people that help with his organization, really had a blockbuster news conference. It was during the National Press Club of May of 2001. I have to tell you that my jaw was on the floor when I saw this press conference, because here you had all of these very respected NASA professionals, FBI people, law enforcement, talking about UFOs. And I thought, oh boy, everything's going to break open now. And then nothing, really, 8 or 9 years, nothing. But recently, the disclosure folks have done another news conference. More history has been revealed to us. Now, admittedly, a lot of these contacts are older, because we're talking about retired folks that just cannot take the secret that they were pledged to take to the grave with them to the grave. They want to come clean. They want to tell the people. They want to let everyone know that we're not alone. We are being visited. And this time, the fact that our best and most protected national defenses are not so operational as we might think is quite an eye-opener. It's no wonder the government didn't want this news to get out, especially while the Cold War tensions were at their peak. Simply trading with aliens might provide a key to immunity for an enemy of America. And this is just not acceptable to what's going on. So what we want to do is we'll share with you this American Morning piece. This is CNN and several other news outlets talking about this conference. So we'll fill you in now on what's going on.
Weekday, 6 a.m. Eastern.
What's your theory behind what's going on here?
This is CNN.
Documents released via the Freedom of Information Act confirm that these types of incidents have occurred going back to 1948.
This is Robert Hastings, UFO researcher and lecturer.
Documents describe saucer-shaped objects whose capabilities are vastly beyond anything that we have, the Russians have. I think the logical explanation is we're dealing with visitors from somewhere else. Regardless, there are a number of cases now. I've interviewed over 120 former or retired Air Force personnel who've talked about UFO incursions at missile sites, at nuclear weapons storage areas. The incident at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana in 1967 did involve the appearance of a saucer-shaped object above a nuclear missile launch site. Seconds later, all 10 of these missiles controlled by this site malfunctioned. And the two officers involved, including former Captain Bob Salas, who was at the press conference on Monday, by the way, testified that he was sworn to secrecy and told never to discuss this. He kept his silence until 1996. All the gentlemen who appeared with me at the press club believe that the American people have a right to know the facts.
But they didn't necessarily believe that theory about why those 10 nuclear sites were deactivated. Why do you believe so strongly that that was truly happening and that it was the result of UFOs as opposed to, let's just say, a malfunction or a military exercise?
Well, what you've just said is not entirely correct. They all agree that there was no technical explanation for what occurred. In fact, the engineering reports from Boeing Corporation stated just that. In fact, all seven of the persons who appeared with me believe that we are dealing with extraterrestrials. Some of them stated it explicitly at the press conference. What they do not necessarily agree with, three of the seven agreed with me that these probably represent a signal being sent. I'm of the opinion that whoever are aboard these craft are telling us and the Russians, because these things have taken place in the former Soviet Union, that humans are playing with fire by possessing and threatening to use nuclear weapons. That is speculative on my part. I've always made that clear. But the persons who were at the sites, who witnessed the craft, say that there is no technology on Earth that could account for what they witnessed.
Your press conference yesterday, Robert, certainly sparked an awful lot of conversation around our offices yesterday. We were talking about this throughout the day, and it raised a number of questions, such as, who are these aliens? Where did they come from? How did they get here? Why, if they have the technology to travel on an interstellar basis, do they care about what we're doing?
I have a book called UFOs and Nukes. I devote an entire chapter to attempting to answer the questions you've just asked. Mm-hmm. I think most of the answers to those questions are in the realm of speculation, frankly. We don't know. The people at the Pentagon and the CIA and the Kremlin may know the answers to your questions. However, what I simply point out is that you have countless incidents now, and I've investigated over 100 of them and have over 100 witnesses, indicate that craft of vastly superior capabilities have been monitoring the U.S. nuclear arms program since the 1940s, and on occasion, according to these ex-military personnel, have tampered with the weapons. What I also point out is the persons who spoke with me on Monday, by the way, again at the press club, were persons who were vetted by the U.S. government to launch or otherwise operate weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
These are clearly level-headed persons that are now saying that UFOs have shut down our nuclear weapons.
Well, so the question remains then, I mean, this has been a subject of conspiracy theories for decades, as you referred to the Freedom of Information Act freeing up some of this testimony so that people can read it. What does the government have to gain by blanket denying that we've ever been visited by UFOs?
The RAND Corporation, which is a think tank, did a study for the Air Force in 1968. The Brookings Institution, which is a think tank, did a study for NASA in 1968. 59, I believe, in which they said basically if extraterrestrials are here, governments have nothing to gain and everything to lose by admitting that without knowing the full intentions of whoever might be here. Are they hostile? We don't know. Do they intend some nefarious activities toward humankind? We don't know. So basically, you know, the odds that the U.S. government is going to admit that there are craft flying around American airspace that run rings around our own aircraft, literally, and we hope they're friendly because we can't control them. And, oh, by the way, they seem to be interested in our nuclear weapons and seem to be shutting them down from time to time. The government has everything to gain by keeping quiet about that.
Well, that is a very good point. When you're talking about the sovereignty of the airspace of the United States of America, you're talking about the fundamental responsibility of the armed forces of the United States. They have a constitutional duty to protect the domestic welfare and to protect us from enemies, foreign and domestic. So, you have unknown technologies with obvious abilities well beyond those of anything that we've developed in our own weapon systems, flying with impunity through the airspace, slow speed, high speed, in the water, in the air, and able to access the highest security locations we have, namely missile silos. And being able to disable, evidently, disrupt the programming with which we control those missiles. And that's the kind of thing that really sends the alarm bells ringing all the way to the center of the Pentagon. Those are the kinds of things that make the red phone ring. And that's why this gets so much energy. That's why, in my opinion, Brooks Agnew, host of X Squared Radio, we see NASA's budget dwindling down to less than $1 billion. Recently, only $330 million. While at the same time, the budget for national defense, against what, I have no idea, the budget for national defense for the United States is $1.3 trillion. Now you see why the X-37B goes up with closed cargo bays, a closed budget, an unpublished manifest, and is able to move around up in space without telling the American people, without even telling Congress what's going on, without even providing the Pentagon itself with the highest resolution images that are available. Well, we're going to take a break right now, but as I take this break, I'm going to play for you some music you may have heard on the radio, but you may not have paid attention too much to the lyrics of this song. I'm going to play it for you, but first I'm going to read the lyrics to you, and then I'll tell you the name of the band. One of these days, the sky's gonna break, and everything will escape, and I'll know. One of these days, the mountains are gonna fall into the sea, and they'll know that you and I were made for this. I was made to taste your kiss. We were made to never fall away. Never. Fall away. One of these days, letters are going to fall from the sky, telling us all to go free. But until that day, I'll find a way to let everybody know that you're coming back. You're coming back for me. Because even though you left me here, I have nothing left to fear. These are only walls that hold me here. Hold me here. The only walls to hold me here. One day soon I'll hold you like the sun holds the moon. and we will hear those planes overhead, and we won't have to be scared. We won't have to be scared. We won't have to be scared. You're coming back for me. You're coming back for me. You're coming back for me. Civil Twilight and the band and the sky, Letters from the Sky is the name of the song. Civil Twilight. So next time you hear that on the radio, and you will, because this band is quite hot right now, I want you to pay close attention to what you heard here tonight, because it's power that you're listening to. It's tremendous awareness, awakenness that's coming out, not only in the news, it's coming out in our music, it's coming out in our writings. If you're getting ready to buy Christmas gifts this year, I want you to keep in mind that remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel, is now available for you at rememberingthefuturebook.com. The reason it might be good for you to buy from the website, of course you can buy with PayPal or a credit card, is that you get the book autographed and you get the audio version for free. So if you're buying it for someone who is going to put it on the shelf, not so good of a reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. You can download it to your MP3 device or to your USB device, plug it into your stereo in your car and listen to it while you're going to work. There's great stuff in there. It empowers you and lets you know that you have access to the past, to the future, and that you can apply it using resonance theory and what we call the Phoenix sequence and unlock the bounty of the universe for yourself. Also, coming up in April is the Pythagoras Conference. You can click on the Pythagoras Conference banner at X Squared Radio, or you can simply put it in Google. You'll find it. The reason it's important is this is in Louisville, Kentucky. Not really one of those cities that you would expect to see a conference of enlightenment with speakers like William Henry, Michael Cremo, myself, Maureen St. Germain, Sandra Sabatini, others that bring you the latest, the brightest, the most forward-reaching information out there, because something is happening. You feel it. I feel it. You hear about it each week on X Squared Radio and other venues out there, coast to coast and others, great speakers, great writers out there telling us something is coming. Something is about to break. Something is about to open. You know, sooner or later, the news gets out. In this case, it's been later. Yes, we had some people in the 50s and the 60s and maybe even the 70s, but no one spoke openly about it. Nobody opened their hearts about it. Nobody spoke about it beyond the water cooler, certainly not at work, definitely not at church. But now the news is getting out. Now it's becoming more mainstream. Now it's resonating in our music and in our books and our movies, certainly. Science fiction has always led the way into the universe. Frontiers that we have crossed, even as we boarded wooden ships and sailed across a flat earth to the edge, when churches told us that we would fall off into space, never to be heard from again. But something inside of us drove us to sell everything, even the labors of the rest of our lives, and in some cases the rest of their children's lives, so that their children's children could enjoy the freedom of the frontier. And they climbed aboard those wooden ships and they braved a 6-month-long freezing journey in small wooden ships, pulled through the sky by linen sails. Toward what? Toward a dream? Toward space? Toward the edge of the known universe? Yes. Yes. To all of those questions. But now there are no more frontiers. Now there is no place we cannot fly to. There is no place we cannot sail to or drive to with enough credit card balance. We can make it. Or is there? Is there a frontier out there? Is there another race to meet? And is it in the future? Or is it a message from our past? Have we been left here, energetically, spiritually, literally, by our relatives, by our Creator? Each Sunday we go to church, we listen to the music resonate through the room in the key of C, or the key of G, or the key of E, to 4-4-6-8-3-4 rhythm. We listen to the voices resonating off the walls, some with energy and some with great talent as they blend with the piano or the organ. And they sing about creation, and they sing about service, and they sing about legacy and origin. And it makes us feel, oh yes, the soul comes alive during those songs. If the choir is singing to us, it can be bringing us to the edge of tears of joy. Or if we are singing those words somewhere in the second or third verse, something about the music, some minor chord, some change in the frequency of the vibrations of that room stimulates something inside of us. It touches us, inspires us. And somehow, each Sunday, 52 Sundays a year, we leave that room feeling cleansed. We leave that room, that chapel, that church, that sanctuary, that synagogue, that mosque. We leave that room feeling as though something the earth has laid on us has been removed from us. Some level of care, some level of magnanimity, mercy, empathy has been instilled in us. And maybe it will last until Wednesday, or perhaps Thursday morning. And then our ability to resist temptation, then our ability to not gossip about our neighbor, then our ability to not hate, our ability to love might diminish, our way of life creeps into our way of thought, and our habits overcome our aspirations. And then we look to Sunday again. And maybe then it will lift us up one more time. One more week. We'll hear a word from the Word, and it may lift us. It may inspire us. Things we have heard over and over again from words which have been written long ago, translated many, many times into many, many tongues, told to us by various teachers, by various speakers, and even read by ourselves from time to time, have a new meaning. Because somewhere in that week, we heard something, we felt something, we experienced something that put us in the place of the writer. So when those words hit us this time, they meant something a little bit different. Yea, though I walked through the valley of the shadow of death. Do you know who wrote those words? Oh, no, no, no. It was not the New Testament writer. Those were not the words that were originally penned. Yea, though I walked the valley of the shadow of death, did not come from the original writer. It came from a reader. It came from a small and frail man named William Tyndale, who translated those words into English those words that give us comfort in times of death or strife or loss, came to us from the edge of those still waters that were imagined by William. And what did he receive for his reward? He was hunted. He was hunted like a dog by foxes. He was hunted like a fox by dogs. He was hunted like a heretic. And he was found. And he was imprisoned in a dark and dank and cold dungeon until his frailty overcame his life. And on the verge of illness beyond recovery, he was pulled from that cell into the courtyard of the jail where he was held. He was strapped to a stake and he was strangled to death and then burned. So when he penned those words for you, which you read in the warmth and comfort of your living room, or which you hear in the inspiring and charismatic chapel, were penned by a man who gave it all, who read and understood what he read, who was empowered by vision to change a stack of consonants into a wonderful and beautiful vision of what we see in the 23rd Psalm. For that, he gave his life. And there are others like him who exist today, who have seen a vision of how we are involved in this galaxy, in this universe. We as sentient beings with intelligence and feeling, with passion and desire, how we are here, and we stare out at night at the stars, planets that move almost imperceptibly across the sky, and we consider our existence here. We worry about what it all means. What is the purpose of life as we struggle from paycheck to paycheck or family vacation to family vacation, and we wonder how we are going to love everyone, and whether we ourselves will ever be loved. And as these pieces come together, we realize how powerful we really are, how our consciousness is involved in the very creation of matter. We realize that there are others that see this. There are other organizations that talk about this. In the quietness of their closed rooms, they ruminate, they pontificate, they consider the import of the relationship of the human race with other races. And as this consideration comes to life, comes to be, great organizations, organizations that are set up and put down and staffed with people, realize we have to consider it. We have to do things to take care of one another. We have to do things to consider our relationship with other races. Because the magnanimity, the extent, the challenge of our love goes well beyond this. Oh yes, well beyond this world. And as they consider that, this is what comes about. Someone, a mouthpiece, a speaker, a contact. So when they come, when their ships reach here, someone will say, take us to your leader. And someone has to decide who that's going to be, who is going to speak for planet Earth. Believe it or not, it's being considered in mainstream. Listen to this. We're about ready to break into mainstream news one more time. Here we
go. Okay, let's talk about Clayton's favorite story.
Yes. Lay it on us, man. All right, listen to this. So, well, this isn't one of my favorite stories. What we have coming up at the end of the hour is, but I think this is funky.
It relates to it, though.
It does, and it's a little offbeat and weird. The United Nations, right? A place where nations come together and have discussions
and unite,
and they unite under the United Nations. They have now appointed an Earth contact for aliens.
Just in case, right? Just in case. We are visited by somebody from another planet or galaxy.
Right.
I love it. Finally, the United Nations is being proactive.
Right,
okay. They're doing something to prepare because they say they need a plan in place in the event that someone tries to make contact from another world.
But hold on.
What?
When you put it that way, you know, let's say we are visited.
Yes.
First thing people are going to say, well, why weren't we prepared? Why do we have somebody waiting at the door?
Why didn't we have someone that had an office we could go
to?
Well,
that's absolutely right. And so she is an outer space liaison, basically. Her name is Maslin Othman. She's an astrophysicist. And she is the person, when they say, take me to your leader.
She's the leader
that will communicate with them. Now, here's the only curious part about this whole story to me. Do they know that? How are we telling the outer space creatures that get in touch with Maslin Othman?
I don't. I would imagine once they land, somebody calls her.
Yes.
Maslin, you're not going to believe this. They're here. We need to fly you where that is.
Yeah, you thought you were going to have a 3 weeks in Bermuda?
Right.
No, they're here. We need you.
But what does she have in her bag, you know, by the door when she gets the call? What's in that bag?
Reese's Pieces.
Reese's Pieces. Take me to your leader.
That's your bag.
That's my
bag. You keep packed at all times.
Look, you know, this is, you know, I hate when, it really drives me nuts when you have, like, a lot of media outlets will do these UFO stories, and they'll put, like, X-Files music underneath it, because there's so many.
Like we're doing now?
No, we're not.
Oh, we're not. Okay.
No, you have, like, government officials who've gone on the record. In fact, Ronald Reagan himself went to the United Nations and spoke and talked about being visited by aliens in front of the United Nations.
Wanting a plan. Right, and they say that they have actually now come up with this coordinated response. I mean, it does stand to reason. Here's her rationale. She says that hundreds of new planets have been discovered, so there's just increasing the likelihood that life will be on one of those planets.
And the Vatican also says the same thing. So at the end of this hour, 8:50, set your clocks. We're going to be talking about it.
Well,
more
I will too. Take a look at these pictures. This UFO that you see right there was witnessed by hundreds of people back in 2006. This was over Chicago's O'Hare Airport. Pilots witnessed it, military officials witnessed it, and the FAA admits it was on their radar. The author, who has spent 10 years interviewing government officials who saw this strange sighting, is here to tell us about it next.
All right, here it is, my favorite segment of the morning. Real or just a hoax? The question comes up whenever UFOs are mentioned, but now some new support that may surprise you. Tomorrow, former military personnel are speaking out for the first time on camera about their personal experiences with UFOs in Washington, D.C. Investigative journalist Leslie Kane has been studying this for years. She's the author of the new book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. She's here to talk about it. Leslie, great to see you this morning.
Great to see you, Clayton.
So you spent 10 years working on this book. You have five different military generals that you've interviewed in this book. How did you manage to pull all this together?
Well, I mean, as you said, I spent a long time working on it. I've published lots of stories on it in mainstream media. And over the years, I started to reach out to some of these very high-level contacts, which you said are generals and military people from around the world, government officials who have investigated this, and just made it a point to get the most official and the highest-level data that I could about the subject.
What I love about your book is you don't put any stories in the book that could be argued with. You call yourself a UFO skeptic. So none of the stories in the book, you say, can be argued with.
I agree with you. I mean, the evidence is irrefutable for some kind of physical phenomenon. And it's well documented in the book through multiple witnesses, radar, ground traces that are left by things that land.
And airline pilots,
right.
Officials, and so forth. Let's start with one, actually. This was at Chicago O'Hare Airport in 2006. This was witnessed by dozens of people there at O'Hare. and pilots as well. Tell us what happened at this one that ended up shocking a lot of people.
Absolutely. There was a disc that was hovering right over the United Airlines terminal, a round metallic-looking disc that lots of people saw, as you said. It hovered there for maybe 5 minutes minimum and suddenly shot straight up through the clouds above it. There was a cloud bank above it and left this absolutely crisp hole in the clouds. People underneath could look up and see the blue through the cloud. So that's basically what happened. A lot of people saw it. None of the witnesses would go on the record because they're worried about ridicule, unfortunately.
Yeah, the pilots and people were worried about losing their job as well. Some other people in Phoenix were worried about losing their jobs for going on the record about the Phoenix Lights. This is one of the most famous UFO encounters ever. And take a look at this video. Thousands of people witnessed this over Phoenix. In fact, you in the book interviewed the governor of Arizona at the time, Fry Symington, about this, right?
Absolutely. Not at the time, but years later, and he is, in fact, probably one of the most famous witnesses, because, as you said, he, too, was afraid of ridicule. While he was governor, he saw this object that lots of other people saw but didn't say anything about it for 10 years. 10 years later, he decided that it was time to make amends to the people that he had withheld this information. It was very important to the people of Arizona that they know that he was one of the people that saw it as well.
And he's featured in the book. Also in the book is McMinnville, Oregon. This one goes back to 1950, and I think this is fascinating. Way before Photoshop, take a look at this photo. What are we seeing here?
Yeah, this was taken like with a Brownie camera. A farmer and his wife were just out on the farm in the middle of nowhere. They saw this disc hovering overhead, ran in and got their camera, took two very, very incredible photographs that have been well documented and studied by laboratories for decades.
Well, I would encourage everyone to pick up this book. If you're sitting there as a skeptic, read it from beginning to end and then make your decisions about it. Leslie Kane, the book is great. It's called UFOs. It is out now. Clueless voters.
So that's the kind of thing that's out there in mainstream. That's what Fox News is considering as they put their news pieces together. This is what great authors are now putting books out there about. This is really happening around us. The frontier is being laid before us, piece by piece. Now, let's talk a little bit about Maslin Otham, the spokesperson for the UN. She is the person now that is appointed by the UN to be the person that answers for the human race. When they up and say, take me to your leader, she is going to be the one. Now, I'm going to play for you a little bit of tape in a minute because it's important not only to see where her thoughts are, but also perhaps because of these thoughts is why she got appointed to be this mouthpiece by the UN, and whether it's going to be respected or not, because obviously there's some trading going on. There's some backroom dealing going on here. This is the United Nations and Maslin Otham's mentioned in this, and this has to do with ET UFO disclosure. Let's listen in. Here we go.
The United Nations even has an Office for Outer Space Affairs, which is, in fact, responsible for promoting international cooperation in the peaceful uses of outer space. Joining me now is author and journalist Nick Pope, who used to run the British government's UFO project at the Ministry of Defence. Thanks so much for joining us. I presume you thought this story was ridiculous from the start.
Well, it's half true, you know. The Royal Society had a discussion meeting earlier this year called The Detection of Extraterrestrial Life and the Consequences for Science and Society. And one of the questions asked was, who speaks for planet Earth? And Dr. Othman simply said, well, look, maybe the UN Office for Outer Space Affairs should have a role in that.
Which would mean her.
It would mean her. So I think what was an intriguing possibility in the mind's eye of the media became a certainty. But scientists are thinking about these sorts of issues. If we pick up a signal, do we reply? If we reply, what should we say?
Who replies?
Well, people are looking for signals using radio telescopes.
Yes.
If we find one of the big issues, and Stephen Hawking has talked about this recently.
The Cambridge professor.
Absolutely. Has said, well, maybe we shouldn't reply at all, because look what happened when the European explorers encountered the Native Americans. Didn't come off too well for the Native Americans. But all these issues now, the scientific community are beginning to think about this, and I think that's interesting.
And is the information and the research coordinated in a way that if a signal did come through, you'd all be discussing it, and you would perhaps put together some sort of response and decide who it would be? Is there any sort of setup or any committee of any kind?
Well, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence have something called the Declaration Protocols, which is really more about verification than anything else. But these issues, these next step issues, should we reply, what should we say? The Royal Society are going to be discussing that at their meeting next week, which I'm going to be attending.
Okay, and just to give us a bit more background about your experience in this, you were in charge of all of this, effectively, for the British government. You came to the conclusion, eventually, from an impartial point of view, that there are UFOs likely to come or have come?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm convinced...
You couldn't write off some of the examples.
I couldn't write... Exactly. The politician's answer. I'm convinced there's life out there. Not sure if we're being visited, but some of the UFO sightings that we investigated, we couldn't explain in conventional terms.
Okay, and so if you had enough resources at the time, how much more would you have researched that, and what do you think your conclusion might have been?
Well, I don't think there's a manager anywhere in the civil service who wouldn't say, please, can I have more resources if available? I would have liked to have obviously hooked up much more with the astronomical community. And it's interesting, the Royal Society, when it's discussing this, brings together a multidisciplinary group of physicists, cosmologists, but even theologians, social scientists. People are talking about the religious implications of this even.
Okay, so when the Royal Society does meet and discuss it a bit further, do you think there is a will within the scientific, theological communities, as it were, to have some sort of representative? It would be the UN, wouldn't it?
It probably would have to be the UN. I don't think it could be a political leader. It couldn't be a religious figure. It would have to be someone who could genuinely say, I speak for the people of this planet. And the UN is probably it, which is where we come back to Dr. Othman. And maybe she is the right choice after all.
Who's fighting it? There must be someone fighting it. This is politics after all.
Well, I don't know. Maybe one of her colleagues was a little bit over-enthusiastic about translating this speculation that the UN Office of Outer Space Affairs might have a role into a certainty. I don't know.
Promoting the department. Thank you very much. Thanks, Aaron.
Well, it's interesting to see that the words that are actually printed on the office door at the bureaucracy of the UN would have enough influence to be able to say, well, you know, you look at the words that are on the outside of my door here. Why, we're the people that are responsible for contact with extraterrestrial races. And so, therefore, because the words say this on the outside of my glass, you know, this is something that we should be doing. I'm going to read for you now something that's been in print for a few years. In fact, my association with Alfred Lambermont Weber put me in touch with this some years ago as I volunteered to be one of the spokespersons for the Peace and Space Initiative. This is called the Space Preservation Treaty. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you because it kind of reads like a resolution. But I'll read the first paragraphs to you and then the headings of each thing, just so you are aware that this kind of thing has been crafted. It has been thought about. It was drafted by legal minds. However, it has not been well recognized. That is to say, it has not been ratified by the nations of the world, and of course, namely the United States of America. And I don't know whether to play for you Maslin's statement, which she made, which the audio quality's okay. I think I'll be able to hear what she says, or whether to read the words of the treaty. I think I'll read the treaty first. Okay, here we go. The states parties to this treaty, recognizing the common interest of all humankind in the exploration and non-weapons use of outer space for peaceful purposes, reaffirming that outer space plays an ever-increasing role in the future development of humankind, emphasizing the rights to explore and use outer space freely for peaceful purposes, keeping outer space from turning into an arena for military weapons confrontation to assure security for all in outer space and safe functioning of space technology. Recognizing that prevention of the placement of weapons and of an arms race in outer space would avert a grave danger for international peace and security. Desiring to keep outer space as an environment where no weapons of any kind is placed. Recalling the obligations of all states to observe the provisions of the Charter of the United Nations regarding the use or threat of use of force in their international relations, including in their space activities. Reaffirming the importance and urgency of preventing an arms race in outer space and of approving concrete proposals on confidence building, which could prevent such an arms race as set out in United Nations General Assembly resolutions on the prevention of an arms race in outer space. Reaffirming the will of all states that the exploration and use of outer space, including the moon, the planets, and other celestial bodies, shall be for weapons-free, peaceful purposes and shall be carried out for the benefit and in the interest of all countries, irrespective of their degree of economic or scientific development. Affirming that it is the policy of the state parties to this treaty to permanently ban all space-based weapons, have agreed as follows. Now, I could read all the articles to you, and I'm sure you would be enlightened by it. But you can easily do a search for Space Preservation Treaty and read them for yourselves. The interesting thing is that this is a largely emasculated body that has made a claim on the expanse of space in the sense that they have demanded in this treaty that organizations such as the highly militarized, very secretive, and extremely well-funded United States of America restrain themselves with respect to putting weapons in space. Now, as we introduce tonight's program, October 17th, 2010, live here from North Carolina, we told you about the X-37B that now is orbiting around the Earth and now has in its cargo bay either a surveillance or weapons system of no report. That is to say, no one other than the small team that sealed that process inside the bowels of that aircraft knows what's there. Nobody knows what it's looking at. Nobody knows what it's pointed at. What we do realize is that the leaders of the United States of America, whether they be political or whether they be military, have it in their minds and have obviously made with their economic decisions it known that we have enemies. We have enemies on this planet, and we perceive we have enemies off this planet. And we will be putting weapons in space to defend against both. We will be putting weapons in space to offense against both. The question is, now that you are empowered as a listener, as an Earth explorer with this information, are you going to sit idle? Are you going to take it? Are you going to agree and thereby through your apathy ratify the idea that a few bold and rather insane individuals can actually put weapons into space, telling the rest of the galaxy that they are not welcome here, that they are not allowed to fly the airspace of our planet, that we own the wind, we own the seas, and now we own the cold blackness of space. And as, shall we call them aliens or off-worlders, as they put themselves together and bring their technology, obviously more advanced than ours, to bear, now they see, we see, that they can fly our skies with impunity. Now we see that we are not so great. We are not so far-reaching that there are other technologies that can fly our skies, examine our Earth, mutilate our cattle, sail our seas, fly our skies, and view us and abduct us any time they like. And there is no great leader to speak for us. So now what I would like to do is I would like to play for you Maslin Othman's speech, just a little bit of it. I've gone into it about 50 seconds because the beginning of it is a lot of introduction stuff. The most important part is to pay attention to her words, and then I'm going to ask you a question at the end of it. All right? Here we go. This is actually Maslin Othman. She is now officially appointed by the Royal Society as the spokesperson for Earth to alien races. Here we go.
Carry the message, and it's a very nice message. I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. But if you really think about it, who would speak on behalf of the people of our planet? I mean, it can't be Martin Rees, it can't be Barack Obama either, I don't think. But, you know, so if we're looking for somebody who might represent planet Earth or the peoples of planet Earth, it could be Secretary General of the United Nations, but of course we can argue that. And it says, to teach, in peace and friendship, I love this, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. And so that was the first of the United Nations message into interstellar space.
So there you have it. So Maslin Othman says in her speech, who will speak for planet Earth? It can't be Barack Obama. It can't be the Secretary General of the United Nations. No, no. It's going to be me. I'm going to be the speaker for the human race. Now, it sounds like a little humor to set the U.S. president aside when it comes to answering for the Earth. But this is about to get very serious, okay? This is just very recently. If the aliens are intelligent enough to make it here without dying in the cold blackness of space, then they also realize that there is no global community here. We are regularly blowing each other up and announcing our hatred and intolerance for one another on a daily basis. How can the holders of superior technology simply land and tell us to quit our squabbles and try focusing on racial survival for a while? And by the way, what would that mean, really, racial survival? That's a great question. Is this planet such a treasure that it might be coveted as a home for another race, while we might be seen as primitive animals who have nearly ruined the whole thing and should be set aside? Barack Obama, not the spokesman for the free world. I can imagine that flying. Do we find the human race in a fight for its survival against this superior technology? might call for the placement of weapons in space. Our history teaches us a long-term tactic for eliminating the other, and by their judgment, inferior race of people. Breed with them. Breed with them until their DNA is so dilute that they cannot claim nor reclaim their heritage. Humans have been doing that for millennia. If we do decide to remain sovereign, then we have an even bigger question. Do they stay or do they go? If they stay, then do we trade with them? If we trade with them, who decides what is bought and how that is going to be shared with the rest of the world? Or is it going to be like, you know, rare collectors moving in with their billions and their trillions and their endless budgets buying the technologies of the aliens and using them at will? Sort of like selling electricity down wires to homes. What a crazy idea. Oh, you have a choice. Pay us or remain in the dark. If they stay and their energy technology can be turned into weapons, how do we keep one nation from dominating the rest of the world? Worse, how do we keep rogue crazies from using the weapons for indiscriminate mayhem? If they stay, who gives them the land, the resources, and the access to what we have laid claim to? Who speaks for the world? Miss Othman? Are you kidding me? And here is the question that many of you have on your minds. When they do share with us the technology to allow us to travel the stars, who gets it? Who gets to travel the stars? Who gets to leave? Who gets to explore? And have they already been doing it? What happens when someone on Earth falls in love with someone from their world and a new race is born? If it is decided by the Earth that they cannot stay, but that they should go, who makes them go? Do we do this with every race that comes to Earth? I mean, what happens if we tell a really nice, advanced race they have to leave, and they do so, and a really nasty one shows up that will not leave peacefully? Wouldn't it be nice to have a technologically advanced buddy around when that day comes? An ally? Someone with whom we can collaborate in order to defend ourselves in this galaxy? There are 200 Earth-like planets within travel distance of Earth, according to the Kepler probe. That number, with improvements in propulsion and, of course, with Kepler's abilities, could grow to thousands very easily. Some of them will have intelligent life on them, and some of them will be more advanced than Earth, and some of them will be warlike, just like we are. After all, isn't it weapons research that has funded all the space programs since the early 1960s? Weren't Eisenhower and Kennedy afraid of the secret war machine that drains the money from the bottom without the knowledge of the people? Absolutely, this is true. I'll play it to you in case you've forgotten it. Here's Robert F. Kennedy speaking about that very thing.
Every word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned. No rumor is printed. No secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program. For from that scrutiny comes understanding. And from that understanding comes support or opposition. And both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people.
All right, so informing and alerting the American people. This is exactly what President Kennedy was talking about. And he wasn't alone. No, not at all alone. There were others who had even more military experience, even more military leadership than Kennedy. And they, too, were afraid of what they had created. January 17th, 1961, President Eisenhower's famous farewell address. I'm sure you've heard it before, but it's pertinent, so I'm going to lay it in right here. This is important to pay attention to. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our societies. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
The main things that I want you to pay attention to in Eisenhower's speech, very, very important. One, who compelled us to build this vast military complex? Why was it necessary to build an organization so large, almost a society, almost an endless industry, whose job it was not to build plows, but to build swords full-time, that we cannot improvise when conflict comes upon us? No, no. Not only must we remain ready for conflict at all times, but if conflict does not arise, then we seek it out and make it happen. He warned us against misplaced power. Misplaced power that the military cannot step in and have an influence on national policy. He mentioned to us that it would threaten our very democratic society, meaning that the people would no longer be represented, that the desires for peace, peace on earth, peace in space, would not be represented. His caution, an alert citizen. An alert citizen. And that's what you are. That's what you are. Because you are an Earth Explorer. You are listening to this program. You, whether live or recorded, now or later, are listening to this program, and it is timely because you have the ability to keep us in check. You have the ability to send to Washington those representatives that will make it so, that will protect us from this military complex, that will make us alive, not just as a people, mortal and fragile, but as a people of souls reaching out to others. We'll take a break for a few moments, and we will have our guest, John Riley with Zero Point Research, coming on with us here at X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We'll be back right after this.
Sudramata.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western North Carolina. Our AccuWindow forecast, about 51 degrees, clear out, about half a moon tonight. If you wait till early in the morning, you'll be able to see Orion, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, and the Pleiades all in the sky at the same time. Quite amazing alignments that are getting ready to happen. Our guest, John Riley, owner of Zero Point Research, is going to join us in a few moments as we finish with Lisa Gerard with her piece called Spirit Dance. I thought I'd share with you a little bit of poetry. Those of you that have flown at night, you might know what this feels like. Night flight, blazing through ethered space at 10 miles a minute, or galaxies of ordered suns with corpuscles of red and white glowing along gray veins. Travelers with sundry destinations, soft halos, lonely and peaceful, spaced evenly in velvet hills. The reflected shimmer of moonlight dancing like white fire across thousands of liquid mirrors hidden in the darkness below. Oh, the condescension of dissension as airspeed yields to gravity and heaven becomes quiet and a tilted wing points toward God. With frozen moonlight gracing silver skin like a dancer's gentle hand mid-leap, and once again wheels make for the green and rolling canvas from which we pray. Those of you that have flown at night would know what that feels like, know what that looks like as you look out the window. As you prepare for the third hour of X Squared Radio, I want you to keep in mind that normally this is when we loosen the seatbelt a little bit, lean the chair a little bit further back where you can see out the window a little bit better. You never know what's going to happen in this hour. We're trying to reach our guest for the final hour, John Riley, who is the owner of Zero Point Research. He is the designer and builder of the Lifestream Generator. Now, those of you that know John, who lives in Santa Monica, California, realize that he came from Lockheed Skunk Works. He was a designer of very auspicious circuitry for Lockheed. And when he left Lockheed, he pursued what in those days was the film industry, special effects. This was before the days of CG. If something needed to be built, like a special mechanism, John was the guy that created the circuitry in his mind. And as a side work, something to kind of fill in the gaps, and it actually became a good source of revenue for him, he copied and made a publishing business out of producing DVDs for various artists. One of those artists, one of those producers of great documentaries was William Henry. And William Henry had gone to Egypt, and he had discussed and discovered and investigated the area known as Abydos, and had photographed a very strange, look like an apparatus on the walls, and of course sent the video, the photographs and everything to John. John was making the copies, and as John's mind would work, he went through the video and saw this device on the walls of Abydos that William Henry had filmed, and listened to William's description of what he thought it might be. Well, John Riley's electrical engineering mind went to work on it, and it began to activate in his mind. And what happened was, he realized what the ancient Egyptians had stumbled upon. or at least tried to recreate. And so he decided that he could put together modern components to mimic this kind of energy, this kind of magnetic energy that would resonate with the human body. And thus the life stream generator was born. Now, it wasn't born by design. It was kind of born by accident, because as the pieces came together and it was assembled and reassembled and reassembled and rearranged, it wasn't working. It wasn't doing anything like what he had imagined it should do, hooked together the conventional way. And then John began to get these downloads, these ideas that, hey, wait a minute. What about if we connect this together in an unorthodox way, in a way that creates some kind of internal feedback, some kind of static magnetic field that rotates at a specific frequency, one that might resonate with bioenergies? And born out of mistake, born out of a subconscious imagination, the life stream was rewired, and lo and behold, the device that changed everything came to be. Now, cognizance was enhanced. Now, biological systems were rejuvenated. Youth was coaxed back into being. The energy of the individual cell that could not sustain itself generation after generation, but rather would continue to diminish an individual energy generation after generation, could be renewed, could be recharged, could be somehow re-energized back to its original youthful energy. And then, should that cell age out and pass away, the cell that replaced it would come in at the newer, higher energy. Then eyesight, suppleness of skin, of blood vessels, of organs, of brain tissues would begin to respond. Now, John will tell you, we make no medical claims whatsoever. But I can tell you from my personal experience that I have seen sufferers of Parkinson's disease sitting next to this machine day after day, week after week, and see an improvement in their cognizance, to see the tremors stop, to see them get back into the therapy pool. In other words, this subtle energy had as much effect without the side effects that the best drugs known to man were having on Parkinson's sufferers. Now I saw something that was really amazing. In helping with various aspects of the manufacturing and the quality control of this device, I learned a lot about it. I own one myself, and I use it on a regular basis. And I can tell you, because in this industry, whether you're speaking on the radio or whether you're in front of the camera at various conventions, some of those conventions are repeated year after year, and you look at, I look at, the films that were taken of me back in 2006 speaking, and I look at the films that were taken of me in 2009 speaking, and one of the things that was told to me by the producer of that film as he came up to me and said, you know, your older brother was here 3 years ago speaking. And I went back and I looked at the film, and he was right. He was right. In 2006, I was older than I was in 2009. Pretty amazing. And I owe it all to the Life Stream Generator. Now, that's not a shameless plug for the Life Stream Generator. I'm just telling you that energy at the proper frequency, the proper magnetism, can in effect in a positive way the biological systems. Now, we're still trying to reach John on the phone. He's at the Conscious Life Expo in Santa Monica, and he may be busy presenting with his live stream generator there at the convention, and that's fine. We have about not quite 40 minutes, no, maybe a little over 30 minutes left in the program. So I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines. You know, we've talked about UFOs. We've talked about mainstream media's response to UFOs, their treatment of UFOs, the idea that this is not one of those obscure things that ends up in the late night talk radio. This is daytime mainstream news. This is Fox News. This is CNN. You know, this is MSNBC. They're talking about it. They're bringing the experts in to the home on a daily basis, and they're talking about the appearance of, the performance of, the importance of the appearance of UFOs. It is now preparing us for what I called 4 years ago Global First Contact. And now an official spokesman with the United Nations has been assigned. So let me open the phone lines again. I would like to know if you have had a personal UFO experience. Now, you know, whether this flies in the face of your religious training that, you know, God is the creator of all life on the earth and Adam and Eve and blah, 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 fill in the blanks, continue the story. We don't have time to go into it right now. Or whether it fulfills your idea or inspires your idea that perhaps there is other intelligent life in the universe besides humanity, that maybe in some sense we're related. Maybe we're all created by the same creator. And if that's the case, how come there are not rules laid out there that one creation can't just go visit another creation? Well, I got news for you, folks. If we had the ability, we'd be jumping in that aluminum can or that titanium can, and we'd be crossing the expanse of space, and we'd be visiting other civilizations out there, learning what we could learn, observing what we can observe. We would do it, and so why not them? I want to know your thoughts on it. If you're off planet, 530-413-4511. If you're east of Earth, 530-413-4515. And if you're west of Earth, 530-413-4520. And if you're just out there listening, that's fine too. You can listen live, free, on your cell phone. You don't have to be near a computer. You can call in at 712-432-0075 and simply dial the access code 318-116. So go ahead and call in right now. All phone lines are open. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about, not just your personal view. You were out in a field or along a highway or somewhere along the beach and you looked up and saw a light in the sky, or you saw a triangle out over the cornfield or the wheat fields. That's fine. We'll take those calls too. But what I really want to know is, what are your thoughts on the importance of the idea that we are not alone, not just in this universe, but we are not alone on this planet. That on planet Earth, there is more than one sentient race living. And I'm not talking about whales and dolphins. I'm talking about living, breathing, flying, respirating, deep beneath the sea, high in the sky, multidimensional beings. Beings with intelligence, beings with purpose, explorers of the universe here next to us. I want to know what your thoughts are. Go ahead and call in right now. Let's talk about it while we're waiting for John to join us. It's important because as we put together these thoughts on the radio, we're also putting together a voyage that you will be very interested in. No, I'm not talking about the North Pole voyage. I know thousands of you are interested in that. We would make that if it were a possibility right now. But what is possible, what is reachable, and what is very auspicious, is that we are going to go to Egypt. Yes, we're going to Egypt in November. November 8th through the 20th, 12 days. Why this specific date? Because members of our team have had an absolute download, an absolute calling that 11-11, we need to be on the Nile in Egypt. I don't mean along the Nile at some hotel with a big group of tourists. I mean on the Nile. We are going to sail the Nile in a small ship. It's capable of carrying 18 passengers and approximately 18 crew members. Now, the crew members are already part of the ship. This ship is specifically designed to sail the Nile in no small amount of luxury. Now, the special that I'm going to give you tonight is because we still have a few seats left on this ship. And we need you. And you need to be there. So here's the special. If you sign up this week, we will give you $600 off the price of passage. That's right. $600 is a lot of money by anybody's standards. $600 here, $600 there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. $600 off, and you can sail the Nile with myself and John. Now, this isn't a big cruise ship. This isn't one of the ones where you stop at the casinos and blah, 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 you know, like we're going to feed you through like cattle and drain every tourist dollar from you. Hardly. This is a small ship. We can go where the consensus of the ship tells it to go. We can stop at islands that have not seen a Westerner for thousands of years. You can sit and lay, if you want to, on a lawn chair in the middle of the night, sailing the Nile in the middle of the desert, looking up at the Milky Way splayed above you, which, as you know, the ancient Egyptians knew that the Nile was an analog for the Milky Way. And at a particular time of the night, when you look up, the river beneath your spine and the sky above your head are lined up one with another. And the star Sirius, rising in the south, is exactly the reason why the Nile flooded each year and spread its bounty for miles on either side of the banks. Now, those days are gone since the Aswan Dam has been built. It's much more stable. But still, you get to access that movement. As we sail the Nile, you will be sailing as the ancients sailed. And you can join us. Now, there are only a few seats left. And what we want you to do is realize if you have ever felt the calling to go to Egypt. You know, there's a thing we call the Giza glow. Yeah. When you go there, there's something about the energy. Being in the center of all the land masses of Earth. Seeing what the ancients saw and why they built the pyramids the way they did and where they did and what they might mean. But there's much more than that. Not only are we sailing the Nile, but we're stopping from time to time. Yes, you will have private time in the temple Edfu. You will have private time, not as a group, not as a piled bunch of tourists, just you, in the Great Pyramid, after hours. Now, there's no tour group that's going to give you this access. I can tell you right now, you will live a lifetime and not get what we are offering you. We are offering you a connection with one of the most amazing ancient edifices on the planet by yourself in the bowels of the Great Pyramid. And if you sign up this week, we will give you a $600 discount that will almost pay for your airfare to get there. We want you to join us. So all you have to do this is click on the banner that says 1111 Egyptian Mystery School at X Squared Radio. That's all you got to do. So if you're sitting next to your workstation on Monday morning and you're wondering, gee, I wonder what I'm going to do in November for a vacation, forget about Christmas. Forget about next summer. You're going to go in November. You're going to go when the weather is perfect. No, it won't be 115 degrees in the shade. No, there will not be big crowds. This is a private journey. You and me and John and a few close friends, we're going to Egypt, and you're coming with us. Please click on the 1111 Mystery School banner at X Squared Radio this week and get involved. You can do it. The thing about this voyage is you're not talking about one vacation this year and one vacation next year, blah, blah, blah. No, 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 no. This is the voyage of a lifetime. This is the kind of voyage you take one time in your life. And you get to go with people who know what they're looking at. We know what we're going after. And we want to involve you in it. We want to share it with you. And if you feel the calling to go, then you've got to click on that banner. You've got to be part of it. So whether you feel great feelings for Egypt, or whether you feel great feelings and great thoughts and great ideas about this blending of two races, or maybe more, with not only the humans that are here on the planet, but also with foreign races, off-world races that may be or have been on this earth for a long time, I want you to go ahead and call in. We've got about, 15, 16 minutes left in the program. It'd be a good time for you to get your thoughts in. 530-413-4515 east of Earth. 530-413-4520 west of Earth. Give us a call and let's talk about it. I'm not talking about, you know, you could talk about your UFO sighting that you may have seen, or one that you found on the internet that you found particularly inspiring. What I'd really like to know from you is, what do you think the importance of it is? Why do you think it's so important? What do you think the true strategy is that mainstream is now covering the idea that UFOs are visiting the planet? You know, I'm a scientist. I'm a commercial engineer. Of course, we're trying to get the electric car company going. And people ask me from time to time, gee, Brooks, do your hobbies get in the way of you doing your real job? Yeah, they do. They do. I have people say to me, you know, the idea that the Earth is hollow, it's not mainstream. The idea that you discuss UFOs is not mainstream. Well, guess what? Wake up and smell the coffee, folks, because it is mainstream. So let's talk about it. Barry from Arizona on line one, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Very good, Brooks. Thank you. Maybe a little off topic from where you're driving, but I just wanted to throw out the idea. Well, actually, just ask you if you're following the work that's being formulated in an effort to cast the cosmos in terms of an electrically driven event as opposed to gravity. In particular, some of the work being done by what they call is the Thunderbolts Project. Who's behind that is Professor Don Scott, a retired professor from UMass, some mythologists. He wrote a book called The Electric Sky, which is fascinating. And it incorporates a lot of catastrophism, some of the ideas of Velikovsky, and they got a proposal as to what made the what looks like rivers on Mars. It's more of a electric discharge between Venus and Mars, of course.
Wow, sounds fascinating.
Good stuff and DVDs to grind through. I'm just curious if you ran into that.
No, I haven't. I now written his name down, Don Scott, Electric Sky. I'm definitely going to seek after him. Is he still around? Is he available for interview?
He just moved, unfortunately, from Tucson to be with his kids up in Scottsdale area. But yeah, they're quite active. Go to thunderbolts.info for a starter, or better yet is I believe it's plasmacosmology.net. That'd probably be the best. Plasmacosmology.net.
Wow.
Great. I think you might enjoy it. And thanks for letting me throw that out.
Yeah, yeah, no problem. Thanks for the hookup. So do you have any ideas on the prospect that we are being visited, and especially now that mainstream media is considering it?
Well, boy, that's tough. It's tough. Obviously, it's tough, or you wouldn't be talking about it. No, I don't think we're being visited per se, unfortunately, but that's just my opinion, and I just like lots of proof, I guess. And hopefully I'll see it one day.
Well, so the idea that maybe you haven't personally seen a UFO.
Well, I have. I've seen two in Tucson. One incredible one sitting right off of looked like Marana over across I-10 about 6 years ago, and two other people also reported it. It was quite astonishing. It was a long large triangular object with lights along the I couldn't tell, you know, as far as dimensions go, but across the surface of it. The leading edge, what appeared to be the leading edge.
And so you just think that this craft either did not come from another world or what?
Well, that goes back to this whole plasma model, in that it could have been some sort of lensing effect. Actually, you know, and that's something I've been working on. The notion that we're actually in the reactive near field of a plasma source, namely the sun, and strange things set up, actually, and that transition to the far field is very close to the heliopause, coincidentally, and I'm trying to determine whether or not that is a coincidence.
So the idea is that it's creating an illusion, or it's allowing you to see something
exactly.
else?
That could very well be. That's one answer to it, an illusion of sorts, yes.
Interesting.
But, you know, then again, this whole situation could be an equally tangible illusion, if you will.
Well, that's true. I mean, the fact that we're having a mortal experience is rather tangential to the idea that we are an eternal being with much more ability than what we're applying Monday through Friday at our work or playing with over the weekends is certainly important and mind-expanding. But it doesn't necessarily mean that our physical existence is an illusion, but more of...
But we're given over to hypnotic states. You know, what comes to mind is Gurdjieff's notion of Kundabuffer, if you remember that from your childhood reading or teenage reading, I don't know.
Well, the idea that we're having a group hypnotic experience that translates, you know, as electromagnetic impulses to the brain as reality, like dreaming about playing basketball is real to us as actually going out and playing basketball.
Right, at a certain level, it sure is. Yeah.
Well, I respect that. I do. And, you know, someone was talking to me today about the idea of pain and the idea of lack or disappointment or scarcity, that, you know, these are such desperate feelings for us that they're very intense. You know, why in the world would we imagine them? Would we bring them on ourselves? And I said, well, you know, that's part of the interest. That's part of the variety of being aware is, you know, someone told me one time that, you know, pain reminds them that they're alive. And it's true. I mean, if you're in bliss, if you're in, you know, total happiness and joy, it's a little difficult to get a grasp on time, on what we call the physical reality. But if you're in pain, oh boy, it's easy to figure that out.
Yeah, things go pretty slow. That's a very unfortunate aspect of our sensible existence, I suppose.
Well, we say unfortunate. I mean, you imagine yourself as asleep or out there disembodied, shall we say. And then you try to imagine pain. It doesn't quite work. It's not like really stubbing your toe. I mean, you could think about stubbing your toe. You can dream about it. But it's not really as invigorating as actually stubbing your toe.
No, absolutely not. And the fact that we have no memory of pain is certainly an aspect of, or a characteristic of God's mercy, if you will, if you've ever been in incredible pain and then you just don't remember it.
That's an amazing observation. Childbirth is certainly one to remember. I mean, mm-hmm. I've often said if the woman and the man had to alternate having the child, that every family would only have three kids because the woman would have the first one, the man would have the second one, and say, I'm never going through that again. And the woman would just go through it a second time because she's a much tougher being than men. We're sissies when it comes to that. But I do remember hitting my little finger on my left hand with a hammer. And I figured out how to never do that again. I use both hands on the handle now. But I did hit my little finger on the left hand. And I remember, I don't remember the pain, obviously, just like you said. But I remember it hurt so bad on my drive home. It was throbbing like the doors were coming off my pickup truck. But of course, I can't recall that now.
Yeah, but, you know, there is something, to distinguish between acute and chronic pain. I'd imagine chronic pain would certainly instill some sort of existential outlook on things. I don't know. Can't imagine living like
that. Yeah, chronic pain brings on despair. And acute pain, you know, brings on good drugs. I don't know. It's the kind of thing that, you know, gee, that really hurt yesterday. But waking up and saying I'm in pain every day, that's something quite different.
Anyhow, so I'm waiting for your guess. Is he gonna make it on?
Well, I don't know. You know, that's one thing about the Conscious Life Expo. If you're there and you have a bunch of people around your booth and they're wanting to buy your stuff, then a radio interview seems kind of ancillary. And we respect that totally. But, you know, if we can bring John on in the next 15 minutes, we'll bring him on. If not, we'll do it another time. The main thing is I wanted people to be aware that this trip to Egypt was available. We've had some openings. We only have a few seats left if somebody really felt excited.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. Sounds like a good time, and I'm sure that you'd be a wonderful host, to say the least.
Well, I appreciate it. I've actually never been a host before. I've always been the person that went with a host, but I thought, you know, we need to go someplace that we have only thought about going, that larger groups can't go and no tour group goes. We're going out in the desert in a town called Domenher, which hasn't been accessed in well over 2,000 years by the West. And one of the members of our team discovered it a couple years ago, and we decided that we should go back. And so it literally took 2 years to get diplomatic approval to go back to this city that actually has a buried temple underneath it, and they may even be excavating it now. Since he was there 2 years ago, it just takes a long time to get these doors diplomatically opened. So this is the first tour group to ever go to this little town.
Wow. I'd be on that plane if I traveled better. But unfortunately, I seem to be aging in a way that I didn't anticipate. So.
No, I understand. I understand. Well, Barry, I really appreciate the call. And if I'm ever out in Arizona, Sedona, or Phoenix again, I'll be sure to let you know, and I'd be happy to meet you.
Hey, that sounds wonderful. There's always an extra room here.
Awesome. Right. Awesome.
Right. Okay. Take care.
Thanks so much for the call. As we we'll keep ringing John and see if we can't bring him on. We've got about 10 minutes left in the program. The program prior to ours was running a pre-recorded program, and it ran about 7 or 8 minutes over. So we might run right up against the hour. Phone lines are open again. I'll go ahead and give the off-planet number one more time because I think, you know, it's pretty quiet out there as far as electromagnetic radiation, meteors, things like that. And someone may want to call in. That off-planet number, 530-413-4511. East of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And west of Earth, it's 530-413-4520. And as always, and I would encourage you to go ahead and just put this in your speed dial, 712-432-0075, anytime after 5 p.m. Pacific time, if you want to listen to X Squared Radio live, you can call that number and then dial the access code 318116, and that will allow you to listen to the program live. Now, what we've done tonight is we've discussed the phenomenon, shall we call it, of UFOs being on the Earth, alien races inside of those UFOs, as not so much a fringe event anymore. Now it's mainstream. We played for you clips from CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and we played for you speeches from past presidents and also the new spokesperson for the United Nations, and we read for you a piece of the Peace in Space Initiative, the treaty that we're trying to get ratified among the nations that we will agree not to put weapons in space. However, at the opening of the program, we talked about the X-37B. This is a small space shuttle. It looks very much like the space shuttle, except it doesn't carry people. It carries technology. NASA gave up on it, ran out of funding early last year, actually. And because of the work that they had done, and because of the idea that this was a retrievable spacecraft, it became of high interest to the United States Air Force. The Air Force, of course, having access to budgets that NASA does not have, was able to adopt the X-37B into its rapid deployment program, into which they poured money and resources in a very rapid form, and lo and behold, the X-37B was put aboard a launch vehicle, and out into space it went on a 9-month mission. What's inside the cargo bay? We have no idea. What its mission is? We have no idea. The reason that we covered it is because it disappeared last week. We have people that are watching for it, and they keep us informed on it. It disappeared. They thought, oh my God, now it's landed. Oh my gosh, maybe it's gone to another orbit. Well, it was found this week, and it did indeed move to a lower orbit, 54 kilometers closer to the Earth, changing its timing around the planet. The question is why? What are they looking for? Why are they up there? What are they doing with this craft? The point is that weapons are being put in space, and that's why this treaty is there, and that's why this spokesperson is there. All right, we now have John on the program. Welcome to the program, John Riley.
Pleasure to be here.
Welcome from the Conscious Life Expo, Hilton in Santa Monica. How's it going out there?
Oh, it's going extremely well. Actually, it was perfect timing. We're loading out as we speak, and as we started taking our booth apart, we just had people that didn't want to leave. You know, we said that the incredible, and, you know, using the live stream technology and doing these wonderful energy circles where people hold hands and we send all this beautiful energy through the groups and just watch everyone just, like, you know, make all these wonderful sounds. But the common denominator is that they're all smiling at the end. So you cannot ask for anything better than that.
Well, we talked about our upcoming 11-11 Mystery School trip to Egypt, and I talked about it, 10 or 12 minutes. And I would like to have your thoughts on this, since you are my partner in this, and we're trying to reach those last few, half a dozen or so people that feel a calling to go to Egypt, but they don't want to go with a big tour group. They want to do something small and private, and they want to go someplace no one else has been before. What can we offer them, John?
Well, one of the things when we understand that we've labeled this tour, the Journey of the Mystery School Initiations, we're following into some very high level of guidance. And I literally had some amazing, fascinating encounters, you know, after you and I talked on Friday, and we really set the intention to send out the very strong message of the synchronicity. So when I sent out my communication to everyone, I literally had people like come up to me at the conference here and stand before me and say, "I'm really feeling going to Egypt with you." And I just look at them and I'm liking what's stopping them. And they have like little excuses, but then all of a sudden, after about 10 minutes of having this exchange, I had two people stand before me and said, "I am going." They said, "I am calling and I'm signing it now." So it's really amazing what's happening now when we look at the synchronicities of the 11-11 journey that we're having, systematically understanding everything that's happening on this planet. And the 11-11, I really want to bring attention to one of my focal points that has been for the last 2 weeks, was about the sunspot 11-11. And I don't know how many people actually saw that, because it was something that was interesting. I was speaking on it, and I said, "We really need to watch the sun when sunspot 11-11 comes around." And it was literally Earth-facing, and it came right across. And right when it was pointing to the Earth, it disappeared. It just literally diminished. And we went into 4 days of spotless sun, if I recall. Since then is when this incredibly large filament has appeared on the sun, and we have about three different sunspots appearing. So 11-12 fired off yesterday, but then they were worried that it was going to ignite the filament, which the filament did not go off. Now, I don't know if anyone realizes how large this filament is. When they measure it, it can go from the moon to Earth. That's how long the filament is on the surface of the sun. So why am I saying all this? It's all about these energy fields that are hitting the Earth and where we are when this happens. So that's the reason why we feel very strong that we are to be in Egypt at the temples on these synchronic dates, you know, especially 11-11, because when we understand this energy that's building. So, and what we've entailed for the travelers is 5-star on such an amazing way. One of the most incredible experiences that I got to experience on my last journey in June is the 120-foot Dalabaya sailing vessel called the Afandina. It is actually this incredibly beautiful ship that is literally, you know what, so intimate and such elegance. And what that allows us to do, allows us to sail the Nile on our own schedule, and we can literally pull over anywhere we wish. We can literally stop at these islands on our way, you know, through the Nile. We can stop and we can swim in the Nile. But what's really important is we can stop on these little islands that haven't had outsiders set foot on them in thousands of years. And it's one of the most incredible experiences when you can actually put your feet in the true black soil of the Kemet, which is, you know, one of the missing alchemies, you know, to really flourish, you know, the fruits and vegetables on this planet again. All these secrets lie in Egypt, and it's all coming forth in such an amazing way. It's not just going to the temple and not with the tour groups. We literally have private sessions where we get to walk into the temples of Horus at Edfu, and it's completely private. We walk in silence, just our group alone, and we get to hear the whispers. We get to sit there in such absolute silence, and we get to go to Dendara, the Hathor temple, in complete silence. We get to go to the Seti temple in Abydos. We get to go to the Osirion in Abydos, and completely in silence. And it's one of the most expanding, amazing experiences to see the sunrise at the Isis temple at Philae. It's something you won't forget. It's just awestruck. It's just incredible. I mean, I can't even put words to that experience. So this is what we have planned: 12 days of absolute magnificence. But it's also, you know, an incredible gift of higher awakening, higher realization of messages that's also going to be part of this group. And it's from the ones that are hearing it, that are all of a sudden there's a desire a call. And one of the things that we, you know, we just ask is just step up to the call, allow no obstacles to come forth. And it's going to allow us to stand there at the Great Pyramid and tell amazing stories of how Paul, you know, avoided our obstacles to be here, to be standing here in the sand in Egypt at this moment. It will not be forgotten. It's definitely a journey of a lifetime.
Well, John, before you came on, I was talking about the special that we have, because we have just a few seats left. We want to fill it out. And I was talking about the $600 discount. If that's per person now, not per couple. So if there's a couple coming, it's $1,200 that you're going to save if you call us up this week and get signed in. What are we going to be doing at the pyramid? That is what people really focus on when they think about Egypt. Besides the more, obscure places like Dahmenhur and Abu Ghraib, these are places the West never gets to see. This is special. But what happens at the pyramid for these guests?
Well, the wonderful thing is in the pyramid, we get to spend 2 hours privately with this star alone.
Oh, I hope we didn't lose John's connection. You know, he's on a cell phone there, and Santa Monica is not far from the airport there, and they get swept by radar from time to time. I want to make sure that he gets a chance to describe this. Okay, John, I think we got you back now. Go ahead and describe what the pyramid experience is going to be like for them.
Yes, well, that's we're given 2 hours of different chambers, including the pit of the Great Pyramid as well, if one desires to do so. That is quite the process to do the 150-foot descent down into the sub-chamber of the pyramid. But it's definitely a life-changing experience nonetheless. And then once we emerge from there, we also get to, you know, stand at the paws of the Sphinx, which is a private time as well. We can, at our own leisure, just stay in that energy and really start to understand.
Now, the Sphinx is one of the big tourist attractions. Of course, it's above ground and it's kind of excavated out, you know, where with tractors and stuff like that, so you can kind of walk down in there. But normally, I mean, you see 300 or 400 people down in this play area at one time. What's it like to go to the Sphinx in a small group where you can stay in the spirit?
Well, that's what's beautiful about it. The nice thing is that we have it privately. Now, there are hundreds of people around the Sphinx, yes, but if you notice, they're not allowed to go down between the paws, and we are allowed. That's a very small handful of people that are allowed to go down to the paws of the Sphinx and actually be able to, you know, to walk up to the tablet and to meditate if one wishes to do so. But being in that silence, and, that really takes us to a whole different level of understanding, to literally look up and see it in such a high level. So with the pyramid, you know, doing the same thing, and if one chooses, you know, when we're in the pyramid, we can have the lights turned out and be in total blackness. That's quite an experience as well.
That's kind of the way that the ancients experienced it, because if you go to these ancient edifices like Dendera, Abydos, and wherever, one of the things that you notice when you get down into the crypts of these places, the tombs that are dug back in to the Valley of the Kings, there's no soot on the walls. They didn't use fire to illuminate their way down into these areas. They either traveled in complete blackness, or they had another source of light.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's one of the mysteries of Egypt that, you know, we scratch our heads to try to figure out. Sometimes when we move into the mystery school processes, and that allows us to remove ourselves from the illusions of what we think we are, the ancient mystery schools show us what we're, and the greatest removal of the fear is to realize that we are, everything that we can think of is possible, and is literally to remove impossibilities from the past. So when one realizes that they could see beyond their normal vision, and they do not need the normal spectrum of light to see, this is something that's really profound if one chooses to do so. So we rarely do this in our walking lives because we have a lit world and we use, you know, that understanding. But when we understand, you know, there's like processes, called dark retreats where you're actually 7, 10, 30 days in the dark, it really changes the chemistry of one person. And so I think that really ties together what the mystery schools were all about.
Well, John, we have just a couple of minutes left. I had told them, the listeners, and there are some thousands that are listening live, and there will be many more tomorrow morning when they go into work and listen to this as an archive. How soon do they need to act? What do they need to do? How do they become involved in this great voyage?
Well, this is the week. You know, if you've mentioned the actual website, you know, to the group about the mystery schools and that SpiritQuestTours.com, you can find all our information. The one key thing is that I want to extend an additional offer, and you mentioned the $600 discount. Now, if they call within this week and mention your name and my name and mention, you know, they want to be part of the 1111 Gateway, we will give an additional $150 off. So that'll be a total of $750 discount.
Wow.
So if that really helps people, that's something that I'm personally willing to extend out.
Wow, that's incredible. So 750 off now. If you sign up this week, you will take the trip of a lifetime with a small group. It'll be led by myself and John Riley with Spirit Quest Tours, which you can check them out on the internet by going to spiritquesttours.com. I promise a higher quality tour company does not exist. Maybe equal. You can get grandeur. You can get large groups. Of course, if you're a big retired organization and you want to go on a big tour with a bunch of other people, that's fine. But if you want to take something private, you want to have an individual experience in Egypt, there's no better time. There's no better place. The time to do it is right now. Well, what we will do, John, it's a couple of minutes after 11 out here on the East Coast. We're completely out of time. I appreciate you joining us out there at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles. I know it's been an incredible experience. I know a lot of people go to that conference, and face-to-face with you in the presence of a live stream, it's quite an experience. That's what you're going to experience, too, on the decks of this ship on the Nile in Egypt, if you join us. All right, we're completely out of time. Looks like we have lost John. He's got to get about his business there, boxing up everything and getting back. I appreciate you all being here tonight. I know that you've been out there listening intently. Not many have called in, and that's fine. We enjoy you being part of X Squared Radio. We know you're out there. We can see your numbers. Listen to those dreams tonight. Pay close attention, because Egypt is calling. SpiritQuestTours.com, or just click on the banner, the 1111 Mystery School banner at X Squared Radio, and we will see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.